superior views and issues from a superior point of view.
It's a new season for the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra, one that requires three conductors.
The recommendation was to have three separate conductors, three separate programs.
But first...
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of
In
the
a
United
session
States.
That pleased and outraged both sides of the political aisle, the Supreme Court issued one decision that bridged the divide and upheld Native American rights.
If this would have been brought into any court, whether it was a conservative court or a liberal court, I think the Supreme Court, we would have come up with the same answer.
God save the United States and this honorable court.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Last month, the United States Supreme Court turned back a challenge to the Indian Child Welfare Act. The act was created to protect the best interests of Indian children and to establish standards for placement of Indian children in homes that reflect the unique values of Indian culture. Tribes have called the law one of the most important pieces of federal Indian legislation ever enacted. Guiding us on the decision and its ramifications in our region are Donna Bergstrom, who is licensed in Minnesota as an Indian Child Welfare Act specialist. She's also a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Marines and an enrolled member in the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians. We're also joined by Tad Johnson. He's professor emeritus and the founding director of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance Program in the American Indian Studies Department of the University of Minnesota. He's been a tribal attorney and tribal court judge and counsel to the Subcommittee on Native American Affairs for the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Donna and Tad.
Thank you, Robin.
So before we get to the challenge of the law and why the court rejected it, what is the law in layperson's terms, if you can, and the reason for it? And we can start with my understanding, which may be limited, that it was created to stem adoption of Native American children into homes where their culture might not be accentuated or may even be discouraged.
Well, I'll jump in here and just say it really stemmed from a report that was done by Congress that showed that Native American children were being removed from the families at rates higher. And of course, this follows along with the boarding school removal, and it was along those same lines. So the process of removing kids was well established, and it continued on into our present day, if you will. And in the late 70s, Congress came up with the notion, and again, I'm really condensing everything here, that Indian child welfare really was important to our nation, and that the strength of the tribe was in the child and the strength of the child was in the tribe. So keeping that connection together was extremely important. And the Congress decided it would be important to have a federal process, a standard that applied across all the states, so that when a child did need to be removed, that was an Indian child, that there were certain standards that were upheld. So that was the genesis for it. And I was, surprised to see that this came before the courts. But, I guess it's been challenged because people don't understand a lot of times that the Indian Native American is a political class. It's not a race. So this does certainly apply to that thought process that we need to keep our Indian children with their tribal community.
Ted, anything to add to that?
No, that was a good summary by Donna. It's a law that's worked well, so the tribes don't lose their tribalism. Essentially, if you lose all your kids, as they had during the boarding school era that Donna referred to, that was happening again in the 60s and 70s, long after most of the boarding schools were not around anymore.
Mm-hmm. As both of you have referred to those outplacements, if you will, may I be a devil's advocate and suggest if I'm non-native and I have a loving home to open up and resources to provide for a child in need, shouldn't that be enough regardless of my cultural understanding or competency?
Well, certainly in Minnesota, where I am, and I'm sure in Wisconsin also, we do have a shortage of foster homes. So that's sort of not the point. I mean, the point of ICWA was to say that if you were taking a child that is recognized as an Indian child out of a home, you need to really be mindful that this child needs to stay connected to their community. And so you need to work a little bit harder to try to find that community. And that may mean, yes, it eventually comes down to you have to place with preference outside of those initial preferences. But your work should always be focused on getting that child connected back to their community.
And to clarify, you use the phrase ICWA, which is an acronym for the Indian Child Welfare Act. And to clarify my devil's advocacy, I refer to loving home, which is probably not a legal term or concept. Am I correct about that, Tad?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot
pretty
of wonderful...
Pretty hard to measure, yeah.
No, I know there's a lot of wonderful non-Indian homes out there that we'd love to adopt Indian children, but I mean, I know a friend of mine who has a wonderful, loving home. He's a member of Leech Lake. He's adopted several kids under the Indian Child Welfare Act, but also has served as a foster parent to, I think, 32 Native American kids. He's up there close to my age, and he and his wife just kind of made a determination early on that they were good parents, and they are. And one of his foster kids he adopted went to Cornell, the Ivy League Cornell, and then Stanford Law School. So anyway, the short answer is there's wonderful Native American homes that there's, as Donna said, there's not enough of them, but there's good people, you know, on the reservations and off that are Native Americans that want kids as well.
Right. I guess the fallacy of my devil's advocate question is to say a loving non-Native home doesn't preclude the fact that there are loving Native homes, too. And again, loving isn't really a legal concept or anything.
It's not, but I'm sure Donna can talk more about the types of homes they look for. But we, as a lawyer, I would take the recommendation of Donna or, you know, another advocate for Indian children, and they generally know the people out there that who have homes that are suitable for children.
And Robin, that brings up a good point. I mean, you're using the word loving, and so, right, we don't have that in there, but there are safety. So there's safety standards. So if they were to come to, say, a family that had a home that needed some help, maybe there was a window broken or a door broken, and the foster family wouldn't have cleared you know, a safe home, it is the county's responsibility to make that home safe, to bring it up to standard so that they could become the foster family for that child, either while they're waiting or even as a long-term placement. So there are standards that are put in place. So there, like I said, it goes back to this working hard. You have to work hard to get these Indian children back to their families, and it might mean a little bit more diligence, and it might mean a construction crew to come in there and help, you know, bring the house up to what the county would consider to be safety standards.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Donna Bergstrom, a licensed Indian Child Welfare Act specialist in Minnesota and an enrolled member in the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, and Tad Johnson, a longtime tribal attorney and tribal court judge, counsel to the Subcommittee on Native American Affairs for the U.S. House of Representatives, and recently retired from the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the recent Supreme Court decision upholding the Indian Child Welfare Act. So here's a little history to the challenge that made it to the court. According to the website SCOTUS blog, the case originated in Texas. It was by the state of Texas and three couples who are not Native American who had tried to foster or adopt children with Native American ancestry, and also the biological mother of one of those children. Their argument was that Congress exceeded its authority in establishing the act, and also that the act violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. We don't have to relitigate it here because the court ruled 7-2 to keep it. What was their logic?
Yeah, so the case was brought in Texas, which for these types of cases is about the worst place to bring a case if you're a Native American. And then it went to the Fifth Circuit, which is also very conservative. And the underlying matter, which Donna mentioned earlier, was, you know, is being a Native American a racial classification or a political classification? For the last 200 plus years, and especially since 1974, when the court ruled that Indian tribes were a political classification. That's been the law. And the other issue was, can the federal law require states to do all this stuff? And they ultimately deemed that the law was constitutional without looking at the race question, which they're going to save possibly for another day, because Justice Kavanaugh in his dissent wanted to, wants the race question brought up. And for the, in the history of federal Indian policy, the kind of textbook definition of who an Indian is someone who's got some Indian blood, but is considered by a community to be a member of a federally recognized tribe by its membership criteria. And the goal of this case by the wider group of like non-Indian gaming industries and other people that wanted to knock down all Indian laws was to have being an Indian determined to be a racial classification, which would have made everything that Native Americans do, whether it's this act or the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act or the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act, they would all be unconstitutional potentially. It'd probably take years to knock them all down, but that was the goal of this case. Ultimately, they upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act, and so the race question may come another day. So anyway, the vote was 7-2. And ironically, the most recent justice to the court, Amy Coney Barrett, wrote the opinion. I was more impressed with the concurrence that that Justice Gorsuch wrote. Actually, that's part of it, but just really gorgeous prose. But anyway, I'd like to hear Donna's take on the case.
Well, before you do, you introduced the word conservative when you mentioned Texas being a difficult place to raise these issues. But the decision was 7-2 with Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissenting. And that means the rest of the court's conservatives voted with the three liberal justices. Donna, you are publicly, of course, a conservative as a former Republican candidate for Minnesota Lieutenant Governor and an officer in the state Republican Party. Is this the liberal conservative thing, or how do you read it?
No, I wasn't surprised at this at all. I think they all understood that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, gives Congress the power to regulate commerce, with Indian tribes and for Indian affairs. And so this perfectly falls in line with that. And we have to remember the process of this ICWA law is to set a standard across the board, just a basic standard level. And we have tribal communities in all the states. So to me, this fell within the Commerce Clause, and I thought that was exactly where it should be. And I know people say, well, children aren't commerce, but it's the fact that Congress gets to regulate, has the power to regulate Indian affairs. And if you kind of dive a little bit deeper, there is money that is associated with our child protection and child welfare. So there always is money attached to these proceedings. But I wasn't surprised because we have a long history, and I think Justice Barrett pointed to that. We have history and a precedence in supporting the ICWA law. So it is a minimum standard. I say that again. It's a minimum standard for the removal. And states like Minnesota, we have the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, which bumps it up a little bit. It says these are the standards, but we actually want you to perform to these levels. So I wasn't surprised. And actually, I'll just touch on Justice Thomas, too, if I can. I mean, I don't know him. And, but certainly in reading his opinion, I think that falls in line with his thinking. He does believe that there is equal protection under the law for all citizens equally. And so I think in reading his dissent, it was basically because he believes in that equal application of the law across the board. And so I think there was some really good information, if you will, that was presented in the majority's ruling. And it lays out what is their thinking behind this. And I think really if this would have been brought into any court, whether it was a conservative court or a liberal court, I think the Supreme Court, we would have come up with the same answer. I think we would have come to this same point.
All right. Well, the distinction that you both made, that tribes are recognized as a political entity rather than a race, is key, particular, again, when you talk about equal protection. And so I'm learning something here. Thank you very much. We're speaking with Donna Bergson, a licensed Indian Child Welfare Specialist in Minnesota and an enrolled member in the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, and Ted Johnson, a longtime tribal attorney and tribal court judge and a lot of other stuff, and an enrolled member in the Boy Sport Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. We're talking about the recent Supreme Court decision upholding the Indian Child Welfare Act. Donna, you touched on this a bit. What does retaining the law mean for us here in Wisconsin and Minnesota?
In Minnesota, we have 11 federally recognized tribes, and in Wisconsin, they also have 11 federally recognized tribes. This is important to us because we have a lot of tribal members, and it's good to know that we have this federal standard that is going to be upheld for all of us. But with this, it is interesting because I am a tribal member, but I've never lived on the reservation, and I don't believe that I have to live on the reservation to maintain my tribal affiliation or my cultural affinity for my tribe. So this recognizes Indian children wherever they are at. And as you know, in the 50s, we had this incentive from the federal government to move Indians off the reservation into big cities like Minneapolis and Chicago so that they could find jobs and, become more mainstream into our community. So you had a lot of folks that left the reservation for these job enticement incentives and stayed there and raised families there. And they're still Indians. They just are not on the reservation. And then you had many that went back and forth, and you still see that. Today, many go back and forth from the big city for a while and then back to the reservation. So I don't think we have to be tied to our land to have ICWA apply to us. I think this ruling established that and enforced that concept.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, on this case and, others, Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, has emerged as really, I guess, the court's most strident defender of Native rights. Surprised by that?
I mean, he's a conservative judge. He came from Colorado, so Gorsuch came from the West, and now they're referring to him as a tribal advocate. But if I could, if you indulge me, Robin, I do have a little bit of his concurrence here. What he said was, often Native American tribes have come to this court seeking justice only to leave with bowed heads and empty hands. But that is not because this court has no justice to offer them. Our Constitution reserves for the tribes a place, an enduring place in the structure of American life. It promises them sovereignty for as long as they wish to keep it. And it secures that promise by divesting states of authority over Indian affairs and by giving the federal government that authority. And then my computer went off. But anyway, as you can see,
he's got a lot more there for you. In any case, Neil Gorsuch is for whatever reason, and his background, as you said, from Colorado, has now a new reputation. Donna, any commentary on that?
Well, I just want to say, really it was President Nixon that championed this. He recognized that it was wrong of the country to be heading down this path, removing Indian children. So I don't, know exactly all the history of how that came about, but he too recognized that there was a sovereignty aspect to the American Indians and that we needed to uphold that and recognize that. And with the courts, they needed to ensure that would continue on. Again, as Gorsuch said, for as long as the tribes want to maintain that sovereignty. And as a result, we all get to pursue life, liberty, and happiness because of that Constitution. And it applies to all of us.
All right. And I'm going to take that as a positive note to end on, applying to all of us, meaning both liberal and conservative, because we did see an alliance of conservative justices and liberal justices on this, even if we had two conservative dissents. The majority was ideologically bipartisan. We can celebrate that, right?
Absolutely.
One of the things that I like to champion is that we really need to give equity so that we can have it really upheld in the way that it was intended.
Mm-hmm. And we are definitely not done, and we'll continue those conversations. But I want to thank you for this one. We've been speaking with Donna Bergstrom and Tad Johnson. We've been talking about the recent Supreme Court decision upholding the Indian Child Welfare Act. Thank you for joining us, Donna and Tad.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
Coming up, the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra season is here with three conductors. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. How many conductors does it take to hold up a 35-year-old baton? Actually, it's not the baton's years we're counting, but those of Warren Friesen, who retired this spring from the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra, which he co-founded and directed since 1988. Replacing him on the podium for this season, that begins next Thursday, are three conductors: Hoyin Kwok of Ithaca College, Aaron Aldridge, concertmaster of our own Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra and professor at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and Lorena Suarez, previously assistant conductor for the DSSO, as well as Opera Festival Berlin. Here to tell us what they'll be conducting are Aaron Aldridge and Charlie Leibfried, the board president of the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Aaron and Charlie.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So the season is three concerts, three consecutive Thursdays, July 13th, 20th, and 27th. Why three conductors, Charlie?
Good question. We just found out for sure that Warren was going to retire this spring, early spring. And rather than try to rush through a search, we just put an artistic committee together. And the recommendation was to have three separate conductors, three separate programs, and then give ourselves some time to find a permanent conductor.
I guess we'll just use the cliche, good things come in threes, right?
That's right.
So, Aaron, you, of course, conduct the UWS Symphony and every other kind of ensemble we can imagine. I've been at I don't know how many performances, and every time I look up, oh, there's Aaron again. In addition to playing violin around the world, first chair at the DSSO, and with Danny Frank's, what we call it, Americana band, Smokey Goad.
Yeah.
Yep. Isn't that enough, or did you need to have one more activity this summer?
I was actually happily surprised. I got a call from Charlie and said, would you be interested in doing one concert with LSCO? And since basically it's made up of all of my friends, I thought it would be a lot of fun, and I love the mission of LSCO. And I love what they're doing. And it's different than anything else in the area. They really have their niche. And I thought that for one concert, it would be really a lot of fun to be able to do a concert with them.
Mm-hmm. And you do point out, right, they're your friends. So it's not like you had to get to know too many people in the chamber orchestra.
Right. Yeah. We all basically everybody who plays, I play with either in DSSO or some other capacity. So yeah, we're all friends and it'll be fun.
So will you be playing, conducting, or just leading with that aforementioned baton?
All of the above. I will be, I'm going to be playing two pieces, so I'll be playing and conducting. What I really look to do is find some off-the-beaten-track compositions. It's something Warren is so brilliant at, is programming and really tapping into these hidden gems and representative and all of the things you want in a program. So the bars has been set so high for 35 years. So I'm doing two pieces. I'm doing the Christian Sinding Suite in the Old Style. So I'll be playing the violin part on that and conducting and playing. And then with my foray into bluegrass and Americana, I wanted to do a piece with that brought in that side of things. So I'm doing Mark O'Connor's Strings and Threads Suite. And then the rest of the pieces that I'll be doing, I'll be holding the baton.
And one of those works is La Bella Cubana by Jose White. We have a performance by you consisting of two violins and piano keyboard, but I'm going to hold off on saying who exactly is playing what until after we hear it. So let's take a listen to this mystery recording, we're going to call it, of La Bella Cubana. Thank you. And that was La Bella Cubana by Jose White. It's one of this summer's offerings by the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra at the Weber Music Hall at the University of Minnesota Duluth, three consecutive Thursdays, July 13th, 20th, and 27th. I'm joined by LSCO Board President Charlie Leifried and one of the conductors, or player conductors, Aaron Aldrich. Aaron, on that piece we just heard, you played the first violin part, of course. Who was the second violin?
That would be me.
Okay. And who was on keyboard?
And that would also be me.
Uh-huh. And that comes from the magic of, what's it called? Okay, so we take video of ourselves and audio, obviously, and then we play it back in a loop, and then we play it back a third time in a case like this, and we merge them all together. A technology worked out during COVID. You and I talked about this before. I think
Yep. You
used it in teaching your students who thought that, you know, when they had to stay home, they weren't going to practice anymore, and you surprised them. is there a name for this thing? And tell us about it. Yeah,
it was definitely a recital early on during the pandemic. I had actually taken a bit of time off, I think naturally, because I had to devote everything into teaching and going online and learning all of this new stuff. And part of the process was learning software that allowed you, I call it the Brady Bunch. You know, that's generally what people refer to it as, the Brady Bunch, when you have the little different windows. And what you do is you lay a track, and then you lay a second track, and then you lay a third, or however many you need. And then you morph them all together in any number of software. I use Adobe Premiere Pro. And one of my big projects was to learn how to do that. So to show that things could be done during COVID to my students, I did a UWS University Recital Series concert that was all me doing duos and trios with me playing all of the parts. So I also did like Handel, Holderson, Passacaglia with violin, viola, that type of thing. And so I learned how to record and edit all in my home office. And that was one of the results.
All right. Well, the other interesting thing is, not for this piece, but the others you mentioned on your performance, the July 20th one, being a player conductor. Is that kind of like being a player manager in sports?
I never thought of it that way. I mean, I think because it's you physically have to lead as you play. It's maybe, I've always considered it more of like a quarterback position. Like where you're kind of calling plays in the you have somebody who's play calling. Sometimes it's quarterback, sometimes it's coach. But sometimes you have to call an audible or call in. So I always kind of viewed that type of thing as more of a quarterback sort of situation.
All right. Well, spoken by a Packers fan, I understand.
Yeah.
Well, again, Aaron's playing management, if you will be at the performance on July 20th. Charlie, tell us about the season premiere on July 13th.
Oh, yeah. The first concert will be conducted by Ho Yen Kwok, who you mentioned already. And he's put together a really interesting program. He had done this collaboration with Neil Farsohi, the violist, on the Ruth Gibbs Jane Grey Fantasy for viola and orchestra. They performed it with the Mississippi Valley Orchestra. So he wanted to program that again and bring her here. So that's really exciting. And then rounding out the program is the Webern L'Ensemble Satz, Ernest Bloch Concerto Grosso number 1, and then the Bella Bartok Divertimento. Should be really, really fun.
Well, let's hear a sample from that program. This is Ruth Gibbs' Jane Grey Fantasy for viola and orchestra.
Thank you.
And that was a selection from Ruth Gipp's Jane Grey Fantasy for Viola and Orchestra, with Hoyin Kwok conducting the Mississippi Valley Orchestra. You can hear Maestro Kwok conducting the work in its entirety with the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra on Thursday, July 13th at the University of Minnesota Duluth's Weber Music Hall. We're speaking with Charlie Leibfried, board president of the LSCO, and Aaron Aldridge, concertmaster of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and guest conductor for the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra. So we've been taking the concerts a little bit out of order here. July 20th with Aaron, July 13th, and July 27th, which would be conducted by Lorena Suarez, for which you have the world premiere scheduled. Charlie, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, a year or so ago, local composer Nina Kaiser was in a conversation with Warren, and she had this piece in mind, and she was intending to feature Mary Lee on the baritone sax solo, and asked if Warren would be willing to premiere this piece. Well, in the meantime, then Warren retired and kind of handed it over to me, and so I contacted Mina and said, are you still willing to have this piece premiered, or is it in production yet? And she said, yes. And Mary Lee was available for that concert as well. So she'll be premiering that concerto on July 27th.
Well, to give a hint of Mina Kaiser's work, let's go out with something from the LSEO's greatest hits reel, if you will. Having its premiere last year was Brittle Bright, the final work of the late Lisko Bassoonist and resident composer Bradley Bombardier, for which Mina Kaiser completed the orchestration. And this is actually the unorchestrated version featuring soprano Sarah Knott. And as we prepare to hear that, Charlie, where can we find out more information about the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra?
Yeah, lakesuperiorchamberorchestra.com for our website, and you can also follow us on Facebook.
Under Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra.
Correct.
The one and only, I assume.
That's right.
We've been speaking with Charlie Leibfried, board president and also trumpet, another player manager, if you will, of the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra, and Aaron Aldridge, concertmaster of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and guest conductor for the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra. Thank you for joining us, Charlie and Aaron.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Hello, Shalon.
Hello, Robin.
Rick Lubbers from the Duluth News Tribune is off this week. So, Shalon, the Lake Walk in Duluth is getting a major facelift, one that's worth $8 million, I understand.
Yes, they certainly are. Now, there are plans to move forward with $8 million of federal grant money for improvements to the Lake Walk. The project is called the Lake Walk Interpretive Plan, and it aims to improve the safety, accessibility, and long-term resilience of the popular multi-use trail. It's also going to increase access for people with disability. According to Duluth's Director of Public Administration, Jim Philby Williams, that means removing barriers for people with wheelchairs. The money will be used to redo a 2.5-mile stretch from Lake Avenue to 26th Avenue East. There is also plans to better separate bicycles from pedestrians. Christy Stokes, the president of Downtown Duluth, shared with my WDIO colleague, Hunter Riley, that anytime we can make our economic drivers, our business community better connected with some of our recreational resources is just a win-win for our community. The Lake Walk has been hit by storm damage in the past. Now, this project will address this by moving vulnerable portions of the Lake Walk away from the shore. And if that's not possible, the plan is to reinforce the shoreline. This announcement yesterday, which was made on the Lake Walk, was attended by Duluth Mayor Emily Larson and U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was instrumental in obtaining the federal funding.
All right. Well, $8 million should buy you some pretty impressive updates on the Lake Walk. Housing prices are rising in the area. How much house can that buy you?
They're not that expensive just yet, but you may not get a bargain by going smaller. There's a tiny house for sale in Duluth's East Hillside neighborhood that's going for $195,000. It's at 804 North 6th Avenue East, and it's a total of 205 square feet. That comes out to $951 per square feet, and you don't get a garage with it, although there is a carport. The listing boasts modern bathroom fixtures and energy-efficient features for sustainable living that will help you to leave a smaller carbon footprint.
Well, those are admirable goals, but how is that price tag going over?
Not so well. If you look at hundreds of social media posts, people are saying they expected it to be in the $30,000 to $50,000 range, and it's an insult to the affordable housing crisis in Duluth. But real estate broker Christy Gilman told the Duluth News Tribune she's seen the invoices and the developers will actually be taking a loss on the project.
Well, in this seller's market, are buyers beating a path to this tiny house's door?
As of this week, no offers are listed on the site.
Okay, well, we'll keep watching. Heading back on the Wisconsin side, or shall I say heading on the bridge to Wisconsin, the federal government is investing in a little bit larger project, the Blatnik Bridge reconstruction. WPR Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading has this report.
The Blatnik Bridge is more than 60 years old, and it's in poor condition. Federal, state, and local leaders touted funding for its replacement at a press conference in Superior on Friday. That was streamed live by WDIO-TV. Democratic Governor Tony Evers said the bridge is one of only two major connections between Duluth and Superior.
And without significant additional funding, the Blatnik Bridge will continue to decay and eventually have to be closed.
Transportation officials warn the bridge is at risk of closing by 2030 if it's not replaced. Regular inspections and maintenance ensure it remains safe. More than 33,000 drivers cross the bridge each day. Minnesota and Wisconsin hope to secure federal funds to pay for most of the project.
That was WPR Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading. She also has checked in with the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, about a program to combat the opioid epidemic.
Most recent state data shows Wisconsin saw a record number of opioid overdose deaths in 2021, with more than 1,400 lives lost. As overdose deaths have spiked, the Bad River Tribe's Harm Reduction Program is offering free naloxone and fentanyl test strips through the mail. Philomena Quebec is the tribe's economic development coordinator.
Wisconsin has a very high opioid overdose mortality rate, and figuring out different ways of reaching people who are at risk is something that we're experimenting with.
The tribe is partnering with a mail-based harm reduction service and public health group Vital Strategies. A senior advisor for the organization says just under 1,000 orders have been filled statewide since the service began late last year. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And moving statewide in Wisconsin, the conservation group Superior Bioconservancy, which is actually based in Milwaukee, has filed suit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Division for the widespread killing of beavers through beaver dam destruction. WPR's Gabby Vinnick has this report.
The federal agency's Wildlife Division is contracted by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on a beaver management program, but Superior Bioconservancy claims that over the last 10 years, the division killed more than 28,000 beavers. President Bob Boucher called those findings egregious. He says the program violates public trust and conflicts with the DNR's mission.
They're not recognizing that this ecosystem engineer, as a keystone species, is critical for us to improve our waters, improve biodiversity, and in many ways is maybe our best ally for climate change.
The DNR declined to comment on pending litigation.
And that was WPR's Gabby Vinnick. We've been joined by Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Thank you, Shalon.
You're welcome, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and WDIO.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more than music to be performed by the Lake Superior Chamber Orchestra in its three-conductor season beginning July 13th. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.